The federal government wants to expand immigration enforcement in the interior states. We'll find out how that works in South Dakota. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, May 28th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley to the program. We'll discuss what's known as the 287G partnership. Jackley says he will use the authority on violent crime and drug cases only in the state. We will dive in to those details. Plus, Linda Duba and Gene Hunhoff join us as today's Dakota Political Junkies. We'll explore the importance of data in appropriations. We'll talk about the state prison project and systems of accountability in state government. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Attorney General Marty Jackley returned from a trip to the U.S.-Mexico border with thoughts on how to move immigration enforcement to the interior states. He recently announced that the State Division of Criminal Investigation, or DCI, is entering into a partnership with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, that's ICE. The goal is to enforce federal immigration law here in South Dakota. He joined me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I want to start with programs that people have many, many questions about, which is the 287G partnership with the federal government. You've signed a memorandum of understanding, and from the federal level, this is the idea to, you know, force multiply people with the authority to work with immigration, you know, federal immigration law. Before we talk about the agreement, what was DCI limited to do before? I mean, could not have asked somebody for their immigration status?
So DCI did not have the ability to do the process and the deportation. They had the ability to call ICE, and we had some challenges in the past where ICE was not as responsive as we'd hoped. I talk about the case out of Vermillion where it was a second-degree rape that we had to put a victim through 16 months of the criminal process. We had to use taxpayer resources on the investigation and prosecution when that's a case that should have been an immediate deportation. In fact, I was upset enough as Attorney General, I put that in a press release saying that this person needs to be deported. He'd been convicted of second-degree rape, wasn't here legally after his conduct. So there are those limited instances where giving the DCI the federal authority to move forward on either a violent criminal or a drug dealer makes sense in what we do. I've limited it to those categories of violent crime, which includes domestic violence, and drug dealers. All the other illegal immigration issues, those are for federal ICE authorities, not for the DCI agents. But I do, in the work that we do, see instances where we're working a violent crime case and we have an option. We can either immediately deport the person, which would be a saving of taxpayer resources and perhaps saving the victim going through the process, or there may be instances when we need to go through that criminal process. But this will give us the option to choose.
All right. So in that case, from before, the perpetrator was incarcerated and went through a regular process as if a citizen, you know, to trial.
Yes. And so
to jail, to prison.
We had that happen numerous times under the past administration. They just were, their policy and position was often, we aren't going to deport an illegal alien that's in custody or an illegal immigrant until you obtain a conviction. What they didn't appreciate is to obtain a conviction, if it's a rape case or a violent crime case, puts a victim through a process they might not want to go through. And it uses a considerable amount of state taxpayer resources to bring a matter through trial, all of which could be avoided if the deportation process began. This 287G just simply will give us the choice. We're not going to do it widespread. I've designated one Eastern South Dakota and one Western South Dakota agent. If we need more and we want to make sure we're servicing the sheriffs and the chiefs, if they have cases that we need to look at, we can. It's just 40 hours of online training, so it's not a significant use of resources. We're going to see how it goes. We're putting headquarters in Pierre where we already have the supervision that we need. So hopefully again, this is a handful of cases a year, but we want to get those illegals that are committing violent crimes and dealing drugs in our state out of our state as quickly as we can, and this allows us that opportunity.
Okay, so I have questions about the resource allocation, but first I want to go back to this hypothetical, which is not really hypothetical because it happened, but it's a good example, I guess, which would be the 16 months that it takes. That's also too many people due process, innocent until proven guilty. So is the assumption then that the person who was accused of the rape would be deported to a home country before trial based on accusation, evidence,
well, based on
status.
Based on status and different standards. In other words, when you're in South Dakota at a university visa, an education visa, or a work visa, you're under certain requirements. So I've always believed in due process. I have no issue with saying the due process is going in front of a judge and providing your identity, providing your right to be there. But to have a full-blown investigation and a criminal trial beyond a reasonable doubt, that's not required of immigration. That's not a legal requirement for due process. Due process, though, is something we would follow with respect to the work we do under the 287 authority.
All right. So let's get back to the details of this authority. Resource allocation, this is the task force model, which could conceivably give you a lot of authority. You've laid out how you're limiting it for clarity. 2 officers, 40 hours of training?
Yep. So it would be 8 hours of total training.
And do we pay for that? Does the federal government pay for that?
The federal government will pay for it, but I will be responsible for their time. In other words, we don't have to pay for the training, but there'll be 40 hours of a salary that they will receive where they're not, in addition to that, working cases.
Officers that are already with your department?
Yes.
Have been allocated to for now. Overtime?
We're going to try to avoid any overtime. Obviously, the agents have pending caseloads, so we're looking for that gap. There might be minimal amount of overtime required. Overtime, unfortunately, with the DCI is a common practice because we don't know when the officer-involved shooting is. We don't know when the rape is. We don't know when the highway patrolman's going to stop and a large drug shipment. So we don't get to necessarily control our hours. But on this instance, we'll do everything we can to avoid it. That way we can simply plug them into their 40-hour schedule. But if they have a court appearance they need to be to or other things, it could trigger some level of minimal amount of overtime pay. But when you look at, for example, that Romanian situation, the thousands and thousands of dollars that were spent on a defense lawyer, on the investigation, putting the victim through a rape proceeding, it's well worth the 40 hours of training.
Yeah. So do you anticipate asking for any increased funding and appropriations next legislative session for this program?
I do not. I don't think it's necessary. If anything, it's going to be a cost savings because I cite those examples. There was a couple instances when I would talk to a frustrated state's attorney. So this isn't just the state. This is the county where one of them said, I can't believe they're going to make me obtain a conviction when this guy's not here legally and they could just ship him out. Instead, I'm going to go through a criminal trial, put a victim through the trial, the cost of the trial, and then the minute there's a conviction, they're going to deport him. That just doesn't make sense. So this will be a cost savings, not just to the state, but to the local government, mainly the counties. But it's going to be in just a handful of cases. There could be a situation where, you know, we could either bring the criminal case or we could deport, but that we feel that deportation isn't the best interest of public safety. It might be a deal where the consulate doesn't appear to be going to take action when we put them back. There may not be protections in place. They may immediately come back to the United States or South Dakota. Then we may need to place them in a jail here in South Dakota. So you just have to balance all the facts. But again, it's keeping the public safe and saving taxpayer dollars.
So I want to go back a little bit because you said what you witnessed at the border also helped encourage you to sign up for this partnership. What did you witness at the border?
So a couple of different things. Let me talk about
the U.S. southern border, I should say.
In Arizona at Yuma. A couple of things. I had an opportunity to first meet with my colleague, Attorney General. There was a point of a leadership meeting. I'm vice chairman of the AGs. I met with the Republican chairman of Kansas and the Republican vice chair of South Carolina. They talked about these are some things that our states are doing and are looking at that would be productive. I think at that time there were 13 states that we're doing some level, not necessarily task force level, but some level of 287G. And at that meeting, ultimately, three additional attorney generals came on board, me in South Dakota, as well as Wrigley in North Dakota. Mm. I also then had an opportunity to talk to a couple of the border agents in the field about the 287G, what they thought, the force multiplier. And based upon those conversations, followed up with a conversation by me directly to Sheriff Milstead. I knew he had 287G, and I wanted to make sure it was working well for Sioux Falls and Minnehaha County. And then I talked, of course, to Director Satterley. So it was based on that big picture that I ultimately decided 287G made sense for us.
So you weren't invited or pressured by the federal government to join?
I was not. In fact, after the meeting with leadership, the nice part of being vice chair of the Attorney General's is I was given the decision maker's cell number, and I reached out to him and got the deal done.
So tell me a little bit about, when you talk about now DCI could do the deportation themselves, what exactly does that look like?
They begin the process. So in other words, let's just say we got a violent crime that comes up, and we're involved in it, and we determine that the person is an illegal immigrant. And let's say we decide that the victim is fragile, she's younger, she doesn't want to go through the criminal process. So at that point, DCI may come to me and say, hey, rather than bring an indictment, let's begin the deportation process. We're part of a task force, so there's regular communication. We would just simply let ICE know the facts and indicate our desire to move forward, at which point they've got all the forms on this. I did this as U.S. attorney all the time. We just begin the deportation process. I would envision if there is a due process hearing necessary, which we call it a due process hearing. It's much like an identity hearing like we have in an extradition from state to state. A little different, but they would be entitled to that hearing, and then they're part of that deportation process, and they're deported.
I want to get to this idea of being able to ask about that status, because this is one of the other criticisms of the program over time, and it's been around for quite some time. But there have been a few criticisms, and one is, you know, you are creating a direct pipeline to removal and deportation from officers that are local and who are not normally involved in this, and that affects community policing and relationships that local people have with law enforcement, what they're willing to report and talk about. So in this a scenario where the victim might be here without status and is concerned to come talk to you, how are you addressing the idea that perhaps people are concerned that DCI now is not the South Dakota folks? They are essentially also ICE agents in certain scenarios.
It's exactly why now I said that we're only going to use this for violent criminals and for drug dealers. So unless somebody in South Dakota is here illegally and committing violent crime or committing drugs, our agents aren't going to be addressing those deportation issues. In other words, I've limited the 287G authority and the work that the agents are going to be doing to those cases that they're already working or a sheriff's working and dealing with violent criminals and drug dealers. The day-to-day routine illegal immigration decisions, those are going to be addressed, as they always have been, by immigration officials and ICE. With respect to the jails and the ones that the Sheriff Milstead comes across, he's got to make those decisions on which ones he's going to use 287G authority on. But for us, DCI is typically involved in the violent crime and the drug dealer situations. Those are the ones that we are going to focus on and make decisions on. Sometimes we'll move forward on the deportation. Other times we'll feel it's just better that we go through the normal criminal process.
And you are making that decision on each case, or are the agents who have been trained in the program, are they coming to you and saying, making a recommendation, and then you're saying, yes, that's what we're going to do in this case?
The way I would envision is the agent would come to the criminal chief would come to me, so that there's a lawyer that gives me a recommendation. So I'll have a recommendation from the agent and the lawyer, and it wouldn't be uncommon that I receive a recommendation from the agent saying go one direction and the criminal chief going the other direction, and I as Attorney General make those decisions every day.
All right. One of the things in the memorandum of understanding is that you can make recommendations for voluntary deportation. That seems like that does not apply, that you're not going to take someone who's been accused of rape and saying, you know, you can voluntarily deport. Am I wrong here, or am I on to a good question?
You're right. I mean, that is an option, but that's not likely what we're going to be using that for. In other words, at the level that I see us using 287G authority, we're in the middle of an investigation. It comes up that there's a determination the person's illegal, or there are circumstances where they violated their work visa or their education visa. Because they could be here legally until they committed a certain conduct,
right. And
then they're illegal. And so those are the ones that we will focus on. This isn't going to be a large part of those agents' duties. Again, I mean, you're going to have a handful of cases. There are several domestic violence ones where we were required to get a conviction before that I don't see us getting that conviction. There is the example of the second-degree rape that I gave. I mean, it's going to be a handful of cases, but they're going to end up being cost savings. But we aren't turning DCI agents into ICE agents. Those federals have those authorities. But if you look at now we're at 16 states that now will have a handful of their agents having this capability. It is that force multiplier. But I'm just being clear, here in South Dakota, that's going to be limited to violent criminals, drug dealers, and they're going to receive due process.
Infrastructure? Do you need IT infrastructure to access the databases? Because we're going back to this idea of, like, how do you know if someone is here without status? You would have, according to the MOA, access to DHS databases, and you could input into them. Is that part of what you see, how you see using the authority, and do you need IT infrastructure to get that done?
We don't need any additional infrastructure. Obviously, this is a task force model. We're part of a lot of different task forces, whether it's the drug task forces, ICAC. We'll run it just like we do there. And so we will have federal partners that have that database, that capability, so it won't require any additional infrastructure.
So by your estimate, and I think you've already answered this question, but just for clarity, how common are instances of criminal activity beyond status among immigrants who are here illegally? I keep hearing you say a handful of times. So I'm thinking like five a year in my mind. But clarify, is that what you mean?
It's a handful. Yeah. I think you're going to see it a little different. Before, this philosophy that you got to get a conviction first, which was frustrating amongst state's attorneys and me as attorney general. A tremendous waste of resources and hard on victims. There's been a change of administration that's not necessarily requiring that, but this is an over time decision that I think is going to be good for our state authorities. There's going to be a handful of times, but those handful are pretty important. I go back to that second degree rape. The victim would tell you that would be a pretty important time not to put her through 16 months. That investigator would say there were other cases he or she couldn't investigate because they were investigating an illegal immigrant situation that should have been immediately deported. You could tell my frustration. You go to the press release that I issued back in April of 24. I even put that in my press release to put pressure on federal authorities to get this deportation to happen.
That program existed then, though.
It did, but it was much more difficult. Another under 287, I would have had to send an agent physically to a bunch more considerable more training that then
would
have triggered
in South
overtime.
Right.
That the new administration has made it more practical for an AG's office, it's a working AG's office like we are, to be able to designate two agents for 40 hours of online training. That's doable.
And you feel like that's enough training to understand the nuances of what you're asking them to do?
We haven't gone through the training yet. It's what the federal authorities say. I mean, I'm gonna reserve judgment. I want my agents to go through that, see how it works, get input from them, and then if they feel they need additional training, I want to make sure they get it so we do this right.
What kind of encounter reports or transparencies are you going to send a press release when you have invoked the 287G authority every time you do it?
Are we tracking it?
Yeah.
I think if it's of newsworthiness, yes. I mean, you started seeing it in my
press. What's that for you? How do you define newsworthiness?
You know,
that might be different than how I define it.
If it's a low-level drug dealer, it's probably not as newsworthy as if it's, 1,000 fentanyl pills or 4 pounds of meth. If it's a second-degree rape, I mean, I've already began putting them in the press releases as a matter of transparency. If you go back to that April 2024 press release, I put it right in there. Mm-hmm. I put it in plea agreements. However, I don't have the authority then to deport. Now with 287G, that language will need to be changed because it'll be more binding within the plea agreement.
Yeah.
So there are a few things that change, but yeah, we don't have any problem being transparent about it. But I don't want the public to think there's going to be a pile of these. I mean, I'm going to guess it's a handful each year.
Right. I think the increased scrutiny is, you know, people are concerned that it's going to be applied to a low-level drug offense that has a low level of criminality for someone who has been in their community for 20 years or has, you know, that the totality of the facts of the case need to be considered. And they're watching to see if South Dakota is deporting somebody who, you know, sold a little bit of marijuana, but really they've been in the construction industry for 25 years. They want to know so they can see that. So that's what I'm asking about, what is newsworthy. If you're not going to do a press release about it necessarily because you have restrictions on your resources as well, is it accessible to the public to where we can look up any time that that authority has been used in South Dakota?
Yeah, I think keeping track and letting the legislature know that probably during the budget process makes sense because it's not something we're going to hide. But I don't want people to think that we are turning into the responsibilities of ICE agents. They have that federal responsibility. There have been challenges in the past of getting deportation, which is why I think this is a good idea. It will save in certain cases, but it's not going to be widespread, and we are not going to be on college campuses looking for trouble. Again, if you're an illegal alien or immigrant and you commit a violent crime or you're a drug dealer, you should be worried about DCI having this authority. Otherwise, you should go about your business.
In Madison, at the businesses, the work enforcement action that was taken, DCI is listed as a cooperating agency. What was your role those arrests?
Typically, when we're cooperating agency, we're back up. So if something bad happens, you know, we have the resources to come in and bring safety to the scene and then do the use of force if there is report. I'll use an example. We just today issued the use of force report from the Pine Ridge tribal officer. And I talk about this case because I think it shows the relationships and the trust between tribal authorities and the Attorney General and DCI. But we weren't involved in that high-speed chase, but yet we come in after the chase, make sure everything's safe, collect whatever evidence we need to collect, and then give a very open and transparent report to the public about what happened. So our role has been typically backup so that if something goes wrong, we bring safety to the scene. And then once we bring safety to the scene, we will evaluate why it went wrong and whether or not there was a proper use of force.
Yeah. In cases like that, you talked about due process and how much you care about that and how important it is to you. How are the public to look at a case like what happened in Madison and evaluate whether due process was followed? Because we don't necessarily know what the charges were against those people. You know, it seems to be a black hole of information afterwards. Rumors get started when you don't have information. What questions should we ask, and what do we already know about that circumstance?
Those need to be asked to the federal authorities because, fortunately, we were backup and we weren't needed. And I say that all seriousness because when we're in a backup situation and when we get called in, that's not a good situation. There's a safety issue at that point. So I don't have all those details. What I would say is this. I've been United States attorney. I've been attorney general. I understand due process and habeas corpus. It's important. I've been in those situations where the wrong individual was either investigated or brought in. And so to have a level of due process doesn't take much effort at all. It is literally something we do in courtrooms every day, all the time. It can be done with a simple identity type hearing. It doesn't take a lot of judicial resources. And then there may be those instances when it turns into more resources. If there's a legitimate question on identity or maybe it's an issue with the work visa, maybe there's an error in it, explainable. But it's always important to be able to get that judge's involvement. And I want that, frankly, in every one of the 287G matters that we use federal enforcement on, I want there to be due process to make sure there isn't a further explanation as to maybe prevent us from doing what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
I don't hide from that. I encourage that. I want that. Because frankly, at the end of the day, it protects me as a prosecutor knowing I've done the right thing and I've sent the right person to where they need to go.
Yeah. Any other things you want to clear up with misperceptions of this or ways that we can watch for success, performance goals, anything that you want us to pay attention to?
No, I mean, the other thing, I think there's a level of misperception too. Why do we need the DCI doing it and the Highway Patrol? And my answer is it's a good thing. They're different agencies that communicate and work well together, but we serve different functions. The Highway Patrol is going to come in contact with many more individuals, the motorists on the highways, the interstates, likely to see more drug issues. We, on the other hand, are going to be more focused on violent crime and coming in on some of the larger drug busts. But we serve different functions. We communicate exceptionally well together. It's not a duplication of efforts. I think it's a good thing that both those agencies have that capability, because there may be a day when my agent's not available and the sheriff's going to need to use the highway patrolman that has that capability. So I think that's a good thing. It's not duplicative. But again, I don't think you're going to see the DCI and the highway patrol trying to take over what immigration authorities' responsibilities are. We're just going to see us better utilizing taxpayer resources to keep us safe in South Dakota.
One of the concerns by the highway patrol is that they do have, unlike DCI agents, daily normative interactions with the public. Your tags could be out of date and you can get pulled over, and then people are concerned about profiling, things like that. Do you know how that's going to work, or is that a question for the Highway Patrol?
That's really a question for the Highway Patrol. I mean, it's an easier question to me, because typically when we roll in as DCI, there's been a violence already happened, right? So we are very isolated and specific on what we're doing. And so it's easy for me to point out in those instances that we're going to limit it to violent crime and drug deals that we're working. But again, I see the Highway Patrol in almost the same level of saying most of the immigration efforts that occur across the nation and in South Dakota, that belongs to ICE. We'll designate some assistance. This is important to us, especially keeping the drugs from the southern border. But we're not going to take over those other functions. We have other responsibilities that we have to take care of.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A recent prison report served as a reality check for the Project Prison Reset Committee in South Dakota. It was perhaps less of a surprise for those who were on a study group related to the prison proposal in years past. Linda Duba is a Democrat and former state representative. Gene Hunhoff is a Republican and former state senator. They are today's Dakota political junkies. And I will say, Senator Gene Hunhoff, welcome back to The Moment. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you. The timing is right. I just finished another batch of kolaches for check day, so I can sit down and rest a few minutes.
Nice. Representative Duba, welcome back. Thank you for being here as well.
Well, thank you so much. I'm in Denver. My grandson turned one on Friday, so we've been having fun.
Oh, what a wonderful insight into what's happening in our lives. I love that. And since the last time that this group talked, there has been another report that was much anticipated. And the news is, the recommendation that not only is there a 1,500-bed men prison that is proposed as necessary, but that on its heels, there will be other facilities because of the growth of the South Dakota prison population. A lot of people are talking about who we sentence and why and what the future is. And Linda Duba, let's start with you. Were there thoughts that when that new prison report came out with, you said, yep, that confirms what I, was thinking, or no, that's a total surprise to me? How did it land with you?
It did not surprise me. We did our due diligence. We worked very hard for 3 years on this. They confirmed what we were experiencing. The thing that we knew would also begin to impact the prison population was Senate Bill, I believe it's 146 from 2 years ago, which I was vehemently opposed to, and so was Senator Hunhoff. We knew, and they point to it in the report, saying because of this bill, we're going to see higher prison sentences, longer prison sentences, more prisoners. We're not going to release them. So everybody keeps pointing to and keeps saying, we've got to change our sentencing structure. We've had to change our sentencing structure for years, and now this truly begins to define it, because there is just I continue to hear there's this sentiment out there, and I, quite frankly, I've read the entire report again, and then I checked out on social media, and people are under the impression that the old prison doesn't need to be replaced. We can just do some updates. Oh, we'll just put another floor on, you know, Jameson and call it good and walk away. Mm. Or we can use these 26 acres over here. The problem is, and then I'll say this other thing. And then there are all these people saying, follow the money. These construction people are taking advantage of us. These are not individuals that are making these statements that know anything about building corrections facilities. So the bottom line is this. We've had overcrowding for years, compounded by our sentencing. This is necessary. And the report also says needs to be located within 20 miles of Sioux Falls. Mm. So all of these things were taken into consideration when we made our recommendation, and they still stand. And you can bet it's going to get even more political.
Yeah.
Great that we're going to look at rehabilitation. Should have been looking at it all along. But that does not solve the problem of ensuring that we have a safe environment for both inmates and for staff that can support ongoing rehabilitation and programming.
Yeah. Senator Hunhoff, the report.
Well, I can't disagree with anything that Representative Duba has said, but a couple things come to mind. You know, they're going to have to prioritize. And the old nurse in me always lives by Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that priority in a person, an individual's life, is safety, food, and you could say housing. And to me, that's where we need to address this problem to begin with, is we've got to make sure that our facilities are current and that they protect and are both our employees and the prisoners that are there. And that's certainly what Representative Duba had to say. You know, there's a summer study that's going on the prison too. And part of that is looking at operational efficiencies and also, I think, some behavioral health aspect in there. As I said, a priority is first the security and safety of everyone that's involved with the prison. And it's been agreed to. We do need a new facility. The second piece of that is looking at what we're going to do to assist those individuals once they're released, so that they can get integrated back into society and become productive citizens. And I think that becomes a challenge because the expenditure is going to go out for the facility, but we've got to be planning and being forward thinking and put steps in process to how we're going to deal this over the next, you know, 2 to 4 years or whatever that time frame is going to be. And I think, unfortunately, you're going to have to address the housing first and get that taken care of. But at the same time, there's got to be another plan out there that we're looking at how those that are released, we can take care of those individuals to be productive.
Linda Duba, this seems like a lot of it is common sense, but then it's also incredibly complicated. And you mentioned politics. Is that what is in the way here? Politics, money? It also doesn't seem to me like corrections is a new thing that people haven't gotten. It's not like we don't know how to deal with AI, for example, because it's fairly new in our, you know, collective consciousness. Corrections has been around since the beginning of statehood here. Help me understand.
That facility was built before we became a state.
Yeah.
So the politics is this. The politics, we were moving along, and when this really started to heat up was when we announced the location. Mm-hmm. And that has continued to be, and then, of course, as a location, so the location became a hot button, and we were putting the funding away, and people were saying, boy, this is expensive, but the location seemed to be the lightning rod. And then when we got our guaranteed maximum price, which it's unfortunate that the legislature did not make that decision to go with it, then that exacerbated it. And we've got a lot of people coming in with all these recommendations. Oh, you don't need to spend that. Oh, you can use what you have. And that is, again, it becomes partly NIMBY, and it becomes we're wasting our money. And everyone needs to take a step back. I wish people would read this report.
I wish people would understand that the safety and living conditions in the current facility are unacceptable for many reasons, but it all becomes a political football. We're not going to spend that money, and we're not going to put it where you wanted it. And if we locate it somewhere else, I want people to understand it's going to be much more expensive because now we're going to have to purchase that land and probably do more prep work. So, again, if you're trying to keep the cost down, look at how we were trying to be effective stewards for the state of South Dakota.
Senator Hunhoff, it's also an election year. And by that I mean Governor Roden, who has not yet announced that he's seeking re-election as governor. But people are thinking about a primary in June in the Republican Party, and that brings up Speaker John Hansen, who has, and Carla Lems, Speaker Pro Temp, Carla Lems, who are running on a joint ticket and have been deeply involved in conversations about the carbon capture pipeline, about the prison. And I was watching Speaker Hansen's announcement video the other day, and he said, day one, we want a South Dakota Doge. That's going to be a key part of his campaign of getting rid of the bureaucracy in state government, handling any kind of corruption in state government. Senator Hunhoff, it seems like that's going to be a big talking point going ahead. Does South Dakota have a bureaucracy problem in state government?
Well, it always says it's like in the eyes of the beholder and what the data is. I think that the timing of all this, when we look at what has happened this past year, even less than a past year, with identification of fraudulent activities that have occurred within departments. And I think that has set the tone that if that is occurring, then your bureaucracy is not overseeing and is allowing these kind of events to occur that result, as I said, in fraudulent activities by employees. As far as, you know, the entire government, I'm going to have to say this. It may seem that we have millions and millions of dollars, which we do, and billions in our budget. But when you think about the process that we go through in trying to allocate our resources and the in-depthness that we do, I think that we have been very good at what we're doing. We hold those departments accountable. And I think what's happened this past year is that the legislature was really focused on policy. You identified the issues that have been out there that drove the legislature this year. But if you look at how the decisions were made, and I'm going to go back to appropriations because that's where, you know, you're going to say you're going to have the heaviness because you're going to cut dollars because there's abuse there and we're not doing a good job. But those dollars are scrutinized. But this year they weren't, in the sense that people, and it's neither right nor wrong, but when you had a new appropriations committee and you only had two or three people on there that had been around before, they had no idea of what was out there, what questions to ask, and more importantly, to go back to the data, to those departments. When you fund a department, they have expectations, and they are supposed to be accomplish those and come back and report on those. And I don't think we saw that. And so by dismissing that and focusing entirely on policy, we can now generate that from these isolated incidences that have happened over the course of the year in DSS and in public safety. Now we have a big issue and there's abuse. But I don't believe that's true. But I think if they had done their homework and really delved into, but again, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt because they don't know what questions to ask. They don't know what they, you know, should be doing in that sense or what had been done previously and didn't go back and look at that. And I think that's really the issue that's out here, that I think the state has done a good job. I think the legislature has done an excellent job. And our governors have set what their expectations have been. And they knew that when they came to appropriations as to what they'd be. And we've identified areas in the past and we've made adjustments. But I think the focus has gone from those incidents to now elevate when due diligence wasn't done by appropriations for what was the expectation out there.
Linda Duba, it's all about the data. What would you add to that?
It is all about the data. And you know what's even more? Senator Hunhoff is correct. You've got to know I like to say, you've got to know what questions to ask and where the bodies are buried. But even more importantly, this, and this was an observation I had early on. Senator Hunhoff knows this from my background in business. Our systems are antiquated. I say that lightly, but I'm going to also say it with conviction. We are finally changing our accounting system. When you don't have good IT systems in place that put in automatic checks and balances, you rely on individuals to find the errors, the mistakes, and it is easier to commit a mistake or B, fraud. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have been investing over the last 2 or 3 years in better systems. We also have been hiring consultants to look at processes. We're doing one right now on human services that has been somewhat successful. That was not necessarily an expense or a focus in the past, or we didn't have the funding to do it. Systems are expensive. They require time and energy. And I'll also say this, and this is not new. Again, I've gone on public record as saying this. We were expecting our employees, as we were turning over these new systems, to do their jobs every day and then to be the designer of requirements and the doer of testing. And they, you know, that's too hard. So what state government needs to do going forward, this is not about DOGE. This is about making sure that individuals who are given a task, have the expertise. So let's go out and contract. And there are resources out there to contract people who can write requirements and do testing and make sure systems work before we turn them over. Mm. This is the way we build back trust in government. And we are taking steps to do this. And our appropriations committee that Senator Hunhoff and I served on together for 4 years, we appropriated fairly large sums of money to look into these departments. In DSS, in BFM, which is the entire accounting system, in the Department of Revenue. Those are three big areas. I will also say that the Department of Health, I'm going to give a shout out to Secretary Magstead. They themselves have been conducting audits in their systems in the way they do business, and they're looking at efficiencies. So these things do exist. We can get better. It's not about corruption. It's about having the right focus and the right people to do those jobs.
You know, 2 years ago, we gave BFM, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it 50 million, representative?
70.
For a new,
$70 million.
$70 million. We gave them because it's an antiquated system. And, you know, we have been dealing with that over the past years. Every time they would come, there was resistance. Well, why should we do this? Well, if you look at any business, they are updated on their technology, but the state of South Dakota, because of the resistance with the legislature, was unable to do that. We've now given them, at that point in time, the dollars to get those systems in place. And I think to re-emphasize what Representative Duba is, you got to have the tools. But that was always the challenge, to convince our legislature that they needed those tools to get those upgrades to make the outcomes that we need to certainly show that we are efficient in our governmental processes.
So does that work ongoing? If that money was allocated, then will we see the benefits of that BFM appropriation going forward, or was it halted in some way?
No, it's not halted, and we will see the benefit, but it's a 4-year project, and they're now in year 2.
Okay.
So again, you have to be very methodical in your approach, and that was the other part of the 70 million. We didn't just buy software. We bought the supports and the staffing and contracted for the staffing that we needed to do the things I talked about.
Okay.
Requirements design, testing, implementation, all of those things are critical. You cannot expect the people who are trying to do their day-to-day jobs to do those things too and do them well.
I see.
So we will see those benefits. I think we're 2 years down the road, but that accounting system impacts almost every department in state government. and we will be more efficient and effective, and we will pieces in place that will ensure that fraud is reduced.
If you listen each year when appropriations meets at their first meeting and BFM comes and does a presentation, and they did it this year, they give an update exactly as to what they've accomplished so far in this process of implementing the new system. So did listen this year, and there has progress been made, but that's part of the accountability that appropriations set, that you need to come back and you need to show us the outcomes that you had to this next point in time.
And as Senator Hunhoff knows, I'm really big on accountability and systems design and testing. I mean, I have a background in it. So I think we're getting there.
Yeah, yeah. Any final thoughts that you're seeing happening in South Dakota state politics that you want to leave us with today? Linda Duba, you go first, and then we'll end with Jean Hunhoff.
Oh, that's a tough question. Senator Hunhoff said it best. We are getting close to an election year. It's a quote-unquote off year, but it's not an off year because of what's going on in the federal government. What we're going to see over the next year is a tremendous amount of belt tightening, and quite frankly, it's a bit scary. We run a very tight budget in the state of South Dakota. We're not looking for new revenues, which is really unfortunate. And Fed funds are getting cut. Departments are being affected. But more importantly, people are going to be impacted with lack of services or reduction in services. So I think we need to keep an eye on that and truly understand who are the people that are being impacted. Are there other places where we can go for that? Or are we going to have to cut back and do without some things? Mm-hmm. That's my takeaway. And I'm concerned.
Jean Hunhoff, final words.
You know, I think it's to watch this summer, see where that recommendation goes through, see what those summer studies are producing, especially the one on the prison for the operational efficiencies. And I think you also have a CPS one that's going on. I think that's going to set the tone, but it is already set out there with the individuals that are interested in running for governor, what their policy platforms are, what they're advocating. I think all of that comes into the mix. But at the end of the day, back to Representative Duba, when you got two appropriators, it's where's the money and what are the priorities and what's the best outcomes we can use with the dollars we have to serve the citizens of South Dakota.
Jean Hunhoff and Linda Duba for today's Dakota Political Junkies. We really appreciate your experience and insight and, of course, your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Former State Senator Jean Hunhoff and former State Representative Linda Duba there for today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation. You can listen to the Dakota Political Junkies as a podcast. Look for it on your favorite podcasting platform. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you in the moment. It's produced by Ari Youngman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.